I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. There were anti-Trump protests in Philadelphia last night and in other cities across the country. This morning, President Obama is welcoming President-elect Donald Trump to the White House and promised a smooth transition of power, saying yesterday, "We are all rooting for his success." Also yesterday, Hillary Clinton publicly conceded the election to Donald Trump, underscoring the importance of accepting the results.
We have seen that our nation is more deeply divided than we thought. But I still believe in America, and I always will. And if you do, then we must accept this result and then look to the future. Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power. And we don't just respect that, we cherish it.
We asked Nate Persily to join us. He's the James B. McClatchy Professor of Law, Politics, and Communication at Stanford University Law School, was the Senior Research Director for the Presidential Commission on Election Administration. And Nate, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Let me quote something that you and John Cohen, Chief Research Officer for SurveyMonkey, wrote in the Washington Post. This was almost a month ago. You wrote, "One of the hallmarks of faith in democracy is a willingness of the defeated to accept the results of the elections." Looking at what Hillary Clinton and President Obama did yesterday, did they do that?
They certainly did. It's not clear that her supporters are ready to take up that invitation. And in the polls that we did, it was more likely that the supporters of Donald Trump wouldn't support the election of Hillary Clinton. But there was a sizable share, at least even early on, who said that they wouldn't accept Donald Trump as legitimate. And I think that that share probably is growing.
Well, and you're already hearing people saying, well, they're not going to accept Donald Trump as their president.
That's right. And I think, you know, this is to be expected, given the lack of faith so many Americans had in democracy and the political process. But it also shows that, you know, it sometimes depends on whether you think your team is going to win or lose. And so while there was a lot of talk and we contributed to it about how Trump supporters had lost faith in American democracy, a lot of that was because they felt that the system was rigged against them. And now it's Hillary Clinton supporters who feel the same way.
I mean, it's such an interesting election in so many ways, and confounding, and I think, for some people as well. And we did have a candidate, Donald Trump, who said that he would reserve judgment depending on the results, whether he would accept the results of this election or not. He implied that if he lost the election, it was an indication that the system was rigged, that somehow the vote was fraudulent. Talked about his opponent being a crook. Essentially, he seemed to be saying the system works if I win. Is that harmful to democracy?
Well, he said exactly that. If you remember, he said that in the event he won, he would accept the results, and lo and behold, he has. But that rhetoric is harmful. But let's be clear: it even before Trump's victory, that type of rhetoric was evident on both sides. It was a different argument about rigging. We saw it in the Democratic primary, where people, particularly those who supported Bernie Sanders, felt that the system was rigged in favor of Hillary Clinton because the DNC's favorability toward her, the media's sort of already showering her with television attention and the like, as well as, you know, concerns about the impact of money in politics. And so the confidence has been declining across the board in both American government and in American democracy.
In fact, it wasn't even a question. It was really a statement that was part of this SurveyMonkey, the statement being, "I have lost faith in American democracy." And that was the statement that you were asking people to respond to. What did you find? What did they tell you?
So we gave people three options, which were, "I have faith in American democracy, I have lost faith in American democracy, and I have never had faith in American democracy." And we found roughly half of Americans had faith in American democracy, 40% said they'd lost faith, and 6% said they never had faith in American democracy. I'm going to definitely run this poll again because we'll see how this has changed as a result of this election. I expect you're going to see the composition of that has changed considerably, so that that, whereas Trump supporters were more likely to say they had lost faith in American democracy. I'm sure it's Hillary Clinton supporters today.
What do you mean by American democracy? We're getting really basic here.
Well, we want it to be really basic, so because it does conflate a lot of things, but it's important to do so, I think, because a lot of the question is whether the question, as we see it, was whether people feel that the system of representative government is one that they have faith in, and that includes both the electoral process, and we have additional questions there about, you know, rigging and the like, but also about whether the government serves them. So it could be that people lose faith in American democracy because they feel that government is just not performing for them, and I think that that's a lot of the story with a lot of Mr. Trump supporters. But it could also be that people feel that the system is rigged against them, either because of the media, as Donald Trump in charge, or the campaign finance system, or voter laws, you know, whether voter ID or the like, or the actual machinery of elections, you know, exposed to hacking and the like, that there was a loss of confidence in the run-up to this election. And this is, you know, going to continue in the coming years.
You also say that this is part of some suspicion and, I guess, frustration with other institutions, whether it's education, the media, religion. It seems like it's across the board.
And that's, I think, an important point to emphasize, because there's going to be there already is, from the commentariat, some conventional wisdom that what happened here was just a signal about government being broken, and this is a signal to Washington about sort of the bad performance of our political institutions. But it's so much more than that, and that is that people have lost faith not only in government, and Congress only gets about 9% sort of confidence ratings and is sort of at the bottom of the barrel, but whether you look at the media or the church or academia or banks and corporations or unions, there's been a loss of trust and confidence over the last 20 years. And so this level of distrust is not unique to politics. It's pervading all kinds of institutions of civil society.
And it seems not unique to the United States.
That's right. And so you can't. It's even worse than just saying it's not politics, and it's worse than saying it's not just American institutions. There's a sense that all these institutions and governments are not living up to the expectations of their populations. And so we see the rise of illiberal parties in Europe. Obviously, we saw the Brexit vote. We see, you know, different types of leaders emerging in other parts of the world, like the Philippines, that are really trying to upset the apple cart.
Is it a matter of expecting too much from our government, the government promising too much, being too blindly trusting in the past of our institutions?
Well, so there's a question I think that needs to be analyzed, which is that how much of it is about the institutions and how much of it is it about contemporary problems? So that is it that the problems that governments are confronting today are simply too much for democracies to deal with? So, for example, if you took the sort of top five problems that governments are trying to deal with, say, rising inequality, immigration, terrorism, cybersecurity, fiscal questions, that and global warming, for sure, that these are the types of questions that that democracies require, it requires cross-national cooperation and long-term thinking. And it's not clear that governments are able to really address those problems as they were sort of maybe simpler problems in the past. But second, I think that one of the sort of underlying themes, I think, of this election is insecurity. And it's insecurity that pervades all kinds of issues. It's economic insecurity as a result of the financial crisis, which was not your garden variety recession. It was a massive blow that came out of the blue for most people, and they see that the fruits of the recovery have not spread down to everyone. Second, there's insecurity, personal insecurity from terrorism. The chance that any given person is going to be affected by terrorism is tiny, but people see it as a surprise. They don't feel that they can sort of plan around it. And then third, the sense of national identity, particularly of white voters in the Midwest that we saw here, but it's more pervasive than that, that the earth is moving beneath people's feet. So what they thought it was to be an American has changed over time. And I think that we see that in Europe with the concerns there expressed toward immigration and terrorism, and we're seeing it in the U.S.
But if our democracy or any democracy is having problems dealing with the challenges, the complexities of the modern world, does that give rise to authoritarian governments? Thinking that, well, you know, if someone can just make the decisions, make it happen, we don't have to worry about elections.
One really good fact from our poll was we asked people whether we would be better off if a single leader had power or whether it was important to divide the power between the president, Congress, and the courts. And 88% of Americans said that it was better to divide power between president, Congress, and the courts. So at least in the United States, there is continuing support for separation of powers. I'm glad we asked that question. At the time, it seemed like a frivolous question to ask, but I think that we still see that. But look, as Churchill said, right, democracy is the worst form of government except all others. And so it's not as if there is an alternative that's waiting in the wings that has mass appeal. What's disconcerting is that people just feel that democracy isn't serving. And then the question is, how do you reform democracy to make people feel better about it?
Do you have any degree of confidence, I mean, looking ahead and looking into your crystal ball, that we have the kind of democracy that can eventually or inevitably deal with some of these problems?
Well, I think that one of the challenges is to see how political leaders respond to this election. If they're is the division that we see in the day after the election for the next 4 years, then I don't think that any institutions are going to be able to channel that sort of a legitimacy enhancing way. So this is not unique to this election. We've been seeing this growing over the last 16 or 20 years. And so right now, 80% of Americans, this was even before this election, say that we are more divided than ever before. And most of them, the large majority of them, say that this is going to last into the foreseeable future. And I'm one of those people.
Well, we're almost having a break here, but there are profound disagreements on important issues.
That's true. I mean, there are, really serious divisions, not just on political issues writ large, but also on sort of world outlooks, right? I mean, that's one of the things that we saw in this election, that it's not just about the policies about which so many people didn't even really know that much about the candidates' positions. It was about sort of the perspective on the world and about, integration of pluralism into the country and the like. And so it's really more than just your normal political issues. It's about what it means to be an American.
Well, we are talking about the impact this past election has had on our political process, civic engagement, even our faith in democracy. And our guest is Nate Persily, professor at Stanford Law School. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Getting comments at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Tell us about your faith in democracy. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Nate Persily. The 2016 presidential election has revealed some deep divisions in our country and questions about our democracy, and that's what we're talking about. Let me get Deb from New Jersey to join our conversation. And Deb, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I appreciate the conversation today. Many of us, I'm a Democrat and voted for Hillary Clinton, would have been fine with Kasich, would have been fine with Jeb Bush. We're fine with the conversation between Republicans and Democrats. It's the man and that he's a mouthpiece for hate that we're not good with.
So if it had been a President Kasich, you would have been fine with that, Deb? You're saying a President Trump creates problems for you?
Yeah, from none of the other candidates on the Republican side this year did we hear the singling out of minorities, the singling out of immigrants, Muslims, and really women. It's hard to say singling out when you're the majority because women are the majority, but we were singled out. We were pointed at. We were demeaned. And I didn't feel that coming from any of the other Republicans who are up there on the dais during the primaries.
Deb, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I mean, Nate, what I hear her, and I'm wondering whether you think Donald Trump creates unique problems for our democracy.
Well, there's no question that there is huge racial division in support for him. Actually, not as much as we might have thought before the election, that he actually did better among racial minorities, at least according to the exit polls, if one is to believe them. But there's no question that the intensity of opposition to Donald Trump is severe and is characterized by racial division, right? I mean, that was part of, I mean, the only real issues that mattered in terms of people's perspectives on Trump had to do with national security, but particularly dealing with terrorism and his proposed Muslim ban. And the second was his attitudes on immigration, both of which have, you know, a serious racial component to them. And then there is, as the caller mentioned, all what I have been calling the sort of worldview perspective here, which is not necessarily about issues, but it's about treatment of others, right? Treatment of different groups, and so that, you know, that does distinguish him from all the other people that the caller mentioned. And I think that, you know, if that rhetoric continues, those differences and anger are going to be solidified.
I mean, we are a deeply divided country along racial lines, I think economic, cultural, religious, identity. It's a long list there. And I wonder whether this election revealed that, or whether there was something about Donald Trump that became a kind of a catalyst that drove people apart.
Well, I think that division pre-existed Trump, and then he capitalized on it. I don't think that, obviously he fanned the flames, but I think that he realized that division could be mobilized, and he capitalized on it. And also that the story so far from the data is that Hillary Clinton simply was not able to replicate the Obama coalition, and so that so many of his supporters simply did not turn out for her because they weren't enthusiastic about her. I mean, as you know, it looks like voter turnout is down by 6 million votes from 4 years ago. And so a lot of the story there is just differential turnout among different groups, not like a rising surge in participation among Trump supporters, but a compositional change of the electorate.
I think we're also, we should know this, but also just seeing, it's not just mistrust, but people that live in distinctly, uniquely different worlds and have a different view of the world because they don't get to talk to each other, get to know each other.
That's right. And that I think is an important part of this story, which is that so we are both geographically segregated and also sort of segregated in our media tastes, right? So that the blue areas are more blue, the red areas are more red, but it's worse than that because even in our lives, when we, go on the internet, we opt into different news sources, and then the facts that we believe are different based on to the echo chambers that we opt into. So there are sort of two different realities, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, there was no institution that could really be a fact checker of sufficient magnitude in this election, because nobody trusted any institution to perform that neutral role.
Well, I think people had their own set of facts, too.
That's right. That's right. And that's because they're opting into news sources with which they believe already.
A comment from Sherry, hashtag not my president doesn't mean Trump was not legally elected. It means we reject the values and policies he supports. It's our right and obligation to fight for the rights for ourselves and others to dissent peacefully. And that's what you're seeing. It means we have an engaged and healthy electorate. What do you say, Nate?
Well, I think that's one perspective. But as I was saying before, when you look at people's faith in democracy, it does have sort of both incumbency related elements and process related elements. And what I mean by that is that to some extent people lose faith when the leaders that have even been duly elected are ones that they disagree with strongly or really hate. And then there are those who just say, well, the process is rigged. And so, you know, the fact that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote is not going to provide any solace to those who think that the constitutional system, the Electoral College, is biased in favor of someone or supporters. And so there is a sort of mix both of this concern about the basic structure and process of government and then the result that it produced.
Let me get Stephanie, looks like Stephanie from Collegeville, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Stephanie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank
Hi
you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm going to swing back to the topic of faith in the democratic process. And my point was I have complete faith in it. After watching the poll results coming in, it was very obvious how our voting efforts and to get out the vote and understanding the process really dictates the success of your candidate, you know, both Republican and Democrat. While my candidate did not win, and I'm, you know, very disappointed about that, I think I've been galvanized to get out there, not to protest, but to take it upon myself to make sure I understand the system. I understand the areas in which I need to make sure that I'm educated about my candidate's choices. And I think that the low information in the understanding of the process is ultimately what leads to the lack of faith in the process.
Well, that's a really interesting comment. I appreciate Stephanie. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Nate, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think related to that is apathy, right? And so as I was saying before, the story of this election is that certain people didn't turn out, possibly because they thought the election was in the bag or because they weren't enthusiastic about the candidate. And so part of the rules of democracy, right, is that if you don't turn out to vote, your voice isn't heard. And so, yes, democracy worked in that sense, that the people who were more enthusiastic about their candidate ended up getting the power to select him.
We heard, and this is not the first time we've heard the phrase low information voters, and whether you believe that or not, and again, that's sort of two separate sets of facts, whether we have a problem of just civic education in this country, whether we really understand how our government is supposed to work.
Well, I think we do have a problem. I'm not so sure this election is reflective of that. I mean, I think that, if the story here isn't that people didn't understand the powers of the president or the separation of powers and the like, I think they just wanted, a certain segment of the population wanted to really send a signal to Washington that everything needs to change. And so because they felt so intensely, they were able to get a majority in the states that mattered.
Let me see what Arthur from Montgomery County has to say. Arthur, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. I just have one question for the guest.
Sure.
And it's this. When will the working poor, and a white America largely, will take responsibility for their voting habits over the past 40 years that has given us this inequality?
Let me ask you,
mainly from the Republican Party, which is made up of anti-slavery, and the Whig Party, which is a little bit of Wall Street. And that's my question.
Arthur, just a quick question. What responsibility do you think the working poor have in creating income inequality?
Well, I think they have given their vote away, largely being the party, a Democratic Party, that or the Southern Dixiecrats that moved into the Republican Party, took that same platform and just largely been a part in number of the Republican Party.
Well, let me see what Nate Persley has to say. What are your thoughts, Nate?
Well, it's an interesting question as to what he means by taking responsibility for it. I mean, I think they're view, which is not irrational, is that, you know, regardless of who the president has been or who has controlled Washington, there has been rising inequality. Now, whether you believe that or not, I mean, because obviously the statistics in the last few years of the Obama administration are a little bit different. But the perception out there was that no matter who we elect, we end up with the same policies, and they're not good for this community of voters, right? And as a result, they opted for a completely different model, right? And so Donald Trump, whatever you will say about him, is a completely different type of option than any of the other options that we've seen in recent or probably ever in American history. And so if you think that the establishment, Republican and Democrat, has not addressed your issues, economic and otherwise, going with a complete outsider is not an irrational choice to make, and we see it happening, you know, around the world in different ways. And so there is a sense in which, you know, people are going to look at this election and say, oh, well, there's no way that this group of voters really could want him or the policies that he represents. When in reality, you know, people were upset based on the information that they were hearing and their own life situation, and they opted for something completely different. And that is, you know, that's not an irrational response. That is sort of what democracy is going to sort of channel when there's discontent of this magnitude.
We have to end on that note. Nate Persley, thanks so much for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Thank you.
He's a professor of law, politics, and communication at Stanford University Law School and was the senior research director for the Presidential Commission on Election Administration. Well, candidate Donald Trump railed against trade deals, promising to renegotiate NAFTA in the first 100 days and withdraw from TPP. He said he would build a wall along the Mexican border, deport millions of undocumented immigrants, slap higher tariffs on imports, cut taxes, spend more on infrastructure, dismantle the Affordable Care Act, and undo a number of the Obama administration policies. We asked Neil Irwin to join us to talk about what a Trump presidency could mean for the economy and for financial markets. He's senior economics correspondent for The New York Times. And Neil, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So why was Wall Street so bullish yesterday on a Trump presidency?
Well, it's interesting. You know, on Tuesday night, as the returns started to come in, the futures dropped, and it looks like the stock market was going to fall on a Trump election. It went the other way. It ended up market rallied on Wednesday. I think what's driving that is people are starting to get away from the kind of generalized sense of fear of, oh, this will be chaos, and start to think about the actual policies he will enact and what they mean for corporate profits, really. So he's promising lower taxes. Republican Congress will likely pass that. He's promising, you know, big infrastructure spending that should provide a boost to the economy. And so in the near term, at least, for corporate profits, for things that stock investors care about, you know, investors are saying, okay, this will be good in at least the first few years.
What about the core supporters? And these are people who want to bring manufacturing jobs back, who feel as if their standard of living is falling. They want to have a middle class life. They want to have what it takes to send a child to college, things like that. What does a President Trump offer them? And they're so key to his victory.
Yeah, you know, his campaign was very light on concrete policy, especially policy that would directly, you know, benefit the middle class and working class people who are, as you say, a big part of his support. You know, you can imagine some things. Look, if the economy really starts roaring after these tax cuts and infrastructure spending, you know, yes, that would you know, benefit working class Americans. But the direct policies he's proposed do not really answer those concerns. The tax cuts he proposes are, you know, very heavily tilted toward the rich. In fact, by some analysis, some middle class people would actually see a tax increase under his plan. You know, he has not proposed things that you know, liberals tend to talk about that might help working class people, like you know, the earned income tax credit, for example, is a tax credit that helps the lower income workers. He has not really talked about any of that, so we'll see if that changes as he actually gets into office and tries to legislate.
But do you think, and certainly Donald Trump said this on the campaign trail, he's going to bring these jobs back, these jobs that either went overseas or disappeared, or perhaps they're in the American South. But he's going to bring back these jobs for people living in Western Pennsylvania that worked in the steel mills, perhaps worked in the coal mines. Are those jobs coming back?
No, I mean, not those types of jobs. You know, you talked about the steel mills, for example. You know, the steel mills it's not trade with China that did in steel jobs. It was the rise of mini mills, it was the rise of new technologies that require fewer people to make steal. You know, and that happened in the 80s. That's 40 years ago, 30 years ago. That's not some new thing that you can just reverse on a dime. Same with coal. You know, the reason coal jobs are declining is because coal as a source of energy is losing its attractiveness compared to natural gas, compared to other things. You know, now could there be a, you know, a economic boost that would, you know, maybe steelworking isn't the job, maybe coal mining isn't the job, but could, you know, jobs making building new roads be available for people? That's a more plausible possibility.
Well, both candidates, I guess all of the candidates probably did talk about infrastructure spending. How much, and these are certainly described as jobs that you can't export because there are bridges and are roads. Is that a key, you think, to either maintaining or even improving our economy?
You know, yeah, I mean, that's actually an area where Donald Trump and a lot of liberal economists would tend to agree. You know, we've been hearing from economists from the Obama administration, from the Hillary Clinton campaign, from economists in the center and in the left for years that, you know, with interest rates very low, this would be a good time to spend a lot of money to enhance, you know, America's kind of long-term potential by bridges, roads, you know, power infrastructure, all kinds of things that that kind of can build the capacity of the economy in the long run. So there's every reason to think that is something that, you know, Republicans in Congress will likely pass that. There's no ideological opposition to that. So there's every reason to think that'll happen in a Trump administration.
Wasn't that part of the stimulus package after the fallout from the recession?
It was. You know, that said, that was passed very quickly. That was kind of oriented toward things that could be done very quickly. You know, the buzzword was shovel ready at the time. They
right.
wanted things that they could pump money into the economy quickly. A lot of these projects take many years to you know, plan and execute. So hopefully, you know, if there is a proposal, it'll be something that focuses on those long-term projects, not just some short-term thing.
Neil, let's take a short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Neil Irwin. He's a senior economics correspondent for The New York Times, and we're talking about what a Trump presidency would mean for our economy, for financial markets, for global markets as well. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Just adding this note, we're shifting gears from the first half of the show. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What do you want from a Trump economy? Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain talking with Neil Irwin, senior economics correspondent for The New York Times, about a Trump economy. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Neil, how do you see trade under President Trump? He talked about renegotiating NAFTA, essentially withdrawing from TPP, assuming he was able to do that to his specifications, what would be the impact on the economy?
Well, it kind of depends on how aggressive and how much he really is willing to risk a trade war, which could really have devastating economic consequences, how much he's willing to risk that to try and get a better deal on some of these trade agreements. You know, TPP is dead for the foreseeable future. It's hard to imagine Congress passing that now.
Right.
But NAFTA has been the law of the land for 25 years. You know, an entire set of intertangled economic relationships between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada have built up. You know, in autos, for example, the supply chains of U.S. automakers go back and forth across the Canadian and Mexican borders, you know, sometimes a dozen times before a finished car comes out. You know, the idea of kind of risking the disruption to a lot of those types of supply networks and economic integration that's taken place, you know, it could be very damaging. Now, you know, maybe what he does is he tries to say, all right, we're going to renegotiate, and they find a few things to make a deal on, and he proclaims victory and moves on, and there isn't much disruption. You know, similar dynamic with China, frankly. You know, we just don't know. You know, how much of Mr. Trump's rhetoric over the last, you know, 9 months, last year and a half, has been kind of posturing and positioning, and how much is really how he seeks to govern. I don't think he knows. Certainly, we don't, because he has a lot of contradictions, and a lot of things that it's just hard to know exactly how to interpret. So it's a big question mark.
Were people, though, hurt by NAFTA? American people?
I mean, it's with something that big and sweeping, it's a complicated story. On net, most of the analysis says we have more jobs, higher paying jobs, and cheaper consumer products because of NAFTA. On the other hand, look, are there communities, are there industries that have suffered where there are fewer jobs? Absolutely. The simple narrative of this election is this is the people who are the losers out of not just NAFTA but other trade deals over the years, kind of striking back and having a blow. That said, I think it's easy to underestimate how much you may, any given person may be benefiting from these things. It's everything from, modern automotive jobs are reliant on those global supply chains, like I said. Even the fact you can go to the grocery store and get cheap avocados. There's a lot that comes out of these trade agreements that is below the surface, not obvious, but a lot of people may be beneficiaries and not realize it.
So big tariffs or tariffs would increase the cost of consumer goods if he negotiates something like that?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, if there's a trade war with Mexico, with China, with Japan, it would result in higher priced products. That's just the nature of if you put tariffs on things that are imported, either those things relocate to the United States, which is a higher cost market to make them, or you pay the tariff and you're paying taxes. So anybody who goes to the grocery store, goes to the store to buy clothes, buy whatever you're buying, in a trade war, those things will get more expensive.
Donald Trump also talked about deporting millions of undocumented workers or immigrants, I should say, and a sizable portion of them work in our economy. If he were to do that, and of course that's a giant if, what would be the impact on the economy?
I mean, the simple answer is there are a lot of industries that are reliant on immigrant labor, and they would face major, major challenges. We're at 5% unemployment. It's not as if there are millions and millions of native-born Americans, ready to go do some of these jobs. So it could increase wages at that low end. That could be a benefit for native-born people who are not deported. At the same time, there are some industries where the entire economics might shift. A lot of agriculture industries, a lot of service industries, restaurants, for example. So, if he follows through on this and really does deport millions of people, it actually lowers the economic capacity of the United States, and it could also mean higher prices for consumers.
And perhaps more E-Verify. I mean, I guess that's one way it puts pressure on businesses or employers to hire people who are not here undocumented?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, is whether the strategy will be literally to have, raids and try and find illegal immigrants and deport them, or whether it'll be, this was a term that Mitt Romney used, people attacked him for, self-deportation. Make it so that there are stricter penalties for employers that employ undocumented immigrants, and if jobs dry up, maybe people themselves voluntarily move back to where they came from. This again falls into the category. We don't really know how Donald Trump will do this as president, but those are some of the possibilities.
Let me get Mike from Germantown to join us. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It just seems to me that Trump's promise for fewer regulations and perhaps the regulations that remain would be a little bit more intelligent would be a big help for businesses. The other thing I'd like to point out is that we have things like OSHA and EPA, the kinds of things that drove Carrier Air Conditioning out of Indianapolis. Those two organizations, of course, they their budget comes from fees and fines, which is not a very positive sort of thing. It's like, I got you, so now I can make my payroll this week. And that's not really the theory on which they were based about, worker safety. It's all about raising revenue. So all these regulations just seem like a full employment program for bureaucrats. Glass-Steagall and those kinds of things, they just encourage small businesses to have to consolidate and get larger because of the administrative cost to comply with all these regs and things. We have a local bank that just merged with a larger bank because of that high cost, administrative cost. I'd love to hear your person's theory about that.
And our person, you're welcome. Thanks, Mike. Our person is Neil Irwin from the New York Times, and I'm sure Mike is not alone. Do you anticipate there would be fewer regulations, maybe fewer regulations related to the EPA and to OSHA under a Trump administration?
Yeah, and that's a safe bet. That's what he says. That's the philosophy of the people he's likely to appoint to run these agencies. Look, this has been an argument that Trump has made and other Republicans have made for a long time that you know, the regulatory state is damaging to business. It restrains growth. It, you know, all of what the caller said are, you know, are arguments we've heard for a long time. A couple things to keep in mind. Look, you know, there certainly can be some truth to that. You know, all these regulations are passed for some reason. And I think the question is which ones are, you know, have outlived their usefulness and are not really doing anything to protect consumers, protect the environment, protect workers, and which ones, you know, as the caller says, are creating busy work and not really making people safer or whatever it might be. You know, the caller mentions Glass-Steagall and Dodd-Frank. I mean, this is and banking regulation. That's an interesting example. Like, the reason Dodd-Frank was passed in 2010 is because of a perception that banks were underregulated, and that created the global financial crisis that caused a giant recession. You know, you can say that there are provisions of Dodd-Frank that are bad or that are poorly designed, but the idea that, you know, you're going to, you know, just eliminate it and you know, let banks do whatever they want and risk a crisis again, you know, that's pretty questionable. And I'd also add, if, you know, Trump himself says he wants to bring back Glass-Steagall, well, that's more regulation, not less. That means, like, going in and breaking up banks. That's what, you know, some people on the left thought Obama should have done and didn't. So, you know, there's a little there's an interesting question of, like, which in trying to do less regulation, which President Trump probably will do, you know, which regulations actually do make sense and have value and which can be ripped up without many consequences. That's the open question. That's going to be the big debate.
Is there any way to anticipate a debt under a President Trump? And certainly among Republicans, there have been a key number of Republicans who want to reduce the debt, who want to cut spending. I don't know if you can cut spending and also cut taxes, but nonetheless, in terms of all of that's impact on the debt, how do you see that, Neil?
I mean, if you take Trump's proposals at face value, the deficit will increase dramatically under his leadership.
Because of tax cuts?
Because of the large tax cuts. You know, that's there's a funny thing. This is kind of there's a track record of this in Republican politics. Republicans are very worried about debt levels when they're out of office and not so worried when they're in office. You know, George W. Bush inherited a surplus and turned it into a large deficit under his leadership because of tax cuts. Same with Reagan. You know, it's you know, the likely course of things is that debt levels will rise unless there is the kind of extraordinary economic boom that Trump has been promising because of his policies.
Let me see what Alicia from Glenside has to say. Alicia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I have a question. Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about, can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead, Alicia.
Oh, sorry. My question was about what the caller was saying about the deportation of millions of illegal immigrants who are here working, and actually most of them are paying taxes, paying into Social Security and helping to support Medicare. All of those workers leave. A lot of economists have come out and said that that's going to be a huge drain on our economy. It's going to actually produce a negative effect. And in addition to that, it's going to put more at risk the Medicare Trust Fund and Social Security. So what does the caller have
sure.
to say to that?
Alicia, thanks for the call. Neil, I've certainly heard that as well.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, the demographic challenge facing Social Security and Medicare is that, you know, the baby boomers are retiring, and so the ratio of working people paying taxes into the system compared to, you know, retirees who are benefiting from the system, that ratio is shifting in a way that makes the finances of these programs more challenging, and you know, if on the current path, we'll need some change. The caller is exactly right. The you know, immigration helps that math. So the more immigrants there are who are paying into that system, the more, you know, the more the finances are sound. So if there really is you know, mass deportations or somehow a big reduction in the labor force, that would make the financial challenges facing Medicare and Social Security over the next couple of decades harder rather than easier.
Alicia, thanks for the call to Radio Times. This was a month or two ago, Neil, when Donald Trump talked about, or actually promising to create something like 25 million jobs over the next 10 years if he is elected. Looking at our job situation, is that plausible?
No, 25 million definitely isn't. I mean, unless there was to be some kind of massive immigration, which is the opposite direction of what Trump is talking about, you know, it is the case. It is true that there are millions of Americans who are not in the labor force, who are not working, not looking for work, who would be if the more, you know, if there had not been a drop in that ratio over the last decade. Now, part of that's due to demographics, right? Part of that is people getting older, people, retirees. You know, nobody's saying that 70-year-olds need to go to work. And so once you take out people who are, you know, retirees, once you take out young people who are, you know, in high school and college and grad school, and once you take out people who are really voluntarily not working, you know, parents who take care of their kids, you know, whatever it might be, people who are disabled, people who are not working for reasons that I think everybody kind of understands, you get to a much smaller number. You don't have a number like 25 million. You have, you know, maybe 5 million.
Oh, really?
So that's where the math, that's how the math looks.
Now, this will take more than a couple of minutes to explain, but one of the things, and certainly the House of Representatives has tried to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, and with a Republican in the White House and Republicans in control of Congress. Neil, do you think the Affordable Care Act is on the chopping block?
It is. You know, what exactly form that'll take? You know, this is going to be a tough, figuring this out is going to be a tricky task for Republicans, especially in Congress. But also the Trump administration, in the sense that, you know, they've had these votes over the last several years repeatedly to try and repeal Obamacare, and that they had the benefit then of knowing that Obama would veto it, knowing that it wouldn't actually happen. So they didn't have to deal with the actual consequences of trying to unwind this law that's very complicated. It's now been the law of the land for 6 years. You know, it affects millions and millions of people's health care. Now it gets to the rubber meets road thing of, okay, do you really want to do a policy change that will cause 20 million people to lose health insurance? You know, will there be a popular outcry from your own constituents if you actually try and do that? And if not, I mean, if so, how do you find a path that gets rid of some of the elements of Obamacare that you most dislike while making sure that people maintain coverage? It's a very tricky balancing act that Republicans in Congress and the administration are going to face.
I think both sides of the political aisle are concerned about the level of income inequality in this country. Anything that you have seen from what Donald Trump has said about taxes, the finances, the economy, that would reduce that divide?
You know, so his tax policies at face value would increase inequality, not decrease it. They're much lower, much bigger tax cut in his proposals for wealthy people and for businesses than there is for middle class and working class people. So on its face, the tax plan would increase inequality. You know, you can come up with a story where some of the other mix of policies could be helpful on inequality. If infrastructure spending creates more jobs at the kind of middle part of the scale compared to the rich, you know, there could be some gains for middle class people there. But on the kind of first level analysis of what his tax plan would actually do, it increases inequality.
I mean, it sounds like trickle down or some version of trickle down.
Yeah, I mean, the plan is to cut the top income tax rate that applies to, I think, people over $400,000 a year from about 40% now to 33%. That's a big cut. Cutting the business tax rate from 35% to 15%. Mm-hmm. You know, those are very, very large cuts. And, you know, there's some stuff in the plan at the middle end, but it's dwarfed by the scale of, you know, if you're somebody making $1 million a year, your potential savings out of this tax plan are enormous.
Well, on that note, Neil Irwin, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Senior economics correspondent for the New York Times, joining us to talk about what a Trump presidency could mean for our economy, for the financial markets, and for the global markets as well. And that's it for the first hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscone. Thanks for joining us.